I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. His restaurants include The French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon, Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc. The French Laundry and Per Se hold 3 Michelin stars, and Thomas has won Best Chef Awards from the James Beard Foundation, among other accolades. He is the author of 4 cookbooks, including The French Laundry Cookbook. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
It took you quite a few years before you bought the French Laundry and your career really took off. You held various cooking positions in Florida, Rhode Island, Catskill in upstate New York. You apprenticed in France. You then went from your first restaurant called Raquel in New York City to another restaurant in Los Angeles. And finally, you landed in Yountville in the Napa Valley. How did you find the French Laundry?
I was in Los Angeles at the time. I was dating a woman who was a wine broker in Los Angeles. Of course, many of her wineries were in Napa Valley. So I would travel with her to Napa Valley probably twice a month. And at that time, there was a chef, colleague, friend from New York City, Jonathan Waxman, who was opening his first restaurant outside of New York in California called Table 29. And during construction, I stopped by to see him one day on one of my trips. He knew I wasn't working. He said, Thomas, there's this restaurant in Yountville called The French Laundry, and I know it's for sale, and I think it'd be perfect for you. And so that was really the catalyst that started the process. And I went to Yountville. I walked on the property of The French Laundry and just emotionally resonated with me. I felt like this was the place.
By the way, this girlfriend, the wine broker, is this the woman whom you started an olive oil company with called Evo in 1992?
Exactly. Yeah, Diane Harder. Exactly. Yeah. Diane and I started an olive oil company called Evo. It was a time when I wasn't working and I was trying to find other avenues from a culinary point of view where I could have an impact.
There's a quote in the French Laundry cookbook which resonated with me. When you first discovered the French Laundry, you said, I gave the French Laundry a new life, and it gave me a new life. And that implies a level of sadness prior to the French Laundry. Was there sadness in your life or restlessness prior to that?
Well, there was certainly a great sense of uncertainty in my life. New York, when I was in New York at Raquel, you know, this city was my home. It was the center of the universe. I never thought I would ever leave New York City. I was emotionally and physically committed to Raquel. And, of course, when that failed, I was set adrift, didn't really know what to do. I spent a year in New York trying to find some connection to something, really didn't, and ended up in L.A. I went out there to be the chef at Checkers Hotel, a great hotel. We got great exposure. It was a great success, but ultimately that was a failure for me. Mm-hmm. And then I was set adrift again in L.A., and I didn't really know what I was going to do. Was I destined to be a chef? Was I cut out to be a chef? As much as I love cooking, as much as I love the fact of nurturing people through food. So the French Laundry was kind of my last effort. Mm-hmm. If that didn't work, I'm not sure what I would have done.
Why do you think Raquel didn't work out?
There's a number of different things. Certainly, you know, at that time in New York, which was the mid-80s, I mean, it was just booming. Americans were learning about French cuisine, about fine dining, and certainly Raquel was a version of that at that moment. Raquel was downtown in a new area, Hudson Square. My partner, Serge Raoul, who owns Raoul's, certainly had great experience in New York and certainly great experience downtown. I had just come back from France, learning about French food, living there, learning really in the detail of French food. And it was a great success for the first 4 years. I mean, the restaurant was 6 years old by the time we closed it. And then, of course, the area didn't develop as that was predicted to develop. We had certainly the stock market downturn. But I think one of the big reasons is I really didn't understand how to run a restaurant. And from that moment on, I knew that if I was going to have another restaurant, if I was going to be lucky enough to have another restaurant in my life, I needed to have individuals involved in that restaurant that knew more than I did about finance, knew more than I did about running a dining room. I was a chef, you know, and a lot of chefs think they can do everything. I realized at that moment at Raquel, at great expense, personal expense, financial expense, that I didn't know everything I needed to know.
I've heard you say that one of the appeals to cooking is the immediate gratification that you get. But looking at your history, it seems like your life has been more of one of a patient gardener, gardener who has to tolerate the erratic nature of the weather and other components out of one's control. What is your temperament?
It's interesting when you say patience. I learned patience relatively later in life, and a big part of that came to me when I was trying to put together the financial structure for the French Laundry and buying the French Laundry. I would call my attorney every day and ask him if there's any news. And finally, one day he said, "Thomas, listen, I'll call you when there's news." And I had to keep myself busy, and I had to learn to be patient. And then, of course, persistence. I mean, I sit here today as a true example of somebody who was persistent.
You talk about patience in the kitchen, and in your cookbook, the French Laundry cookbook, you talk about being mindful about cutting an artichoke. What are some other examples of your being mindful of the mundane in the kitchen?
Cooking is repetition, and I think that as cooks, you have to be comfortable with knowing that you're going to be doing the same thing your entire career. And of course, that's going to change and evolve, but at the basis of what you're doing, you're cooking, whether it's sautéing or braising or roasting or chopping or slicing or dicing, plating food. I mean, all the poaching, even the new sous vide technology that we're using in the kitchen, all those, once you've mastered them, once you've learned them, you're going to be doing them. They're part of the daily routine. They're part of your daily structure. Repetition, in many ways, liberates you to be working on other things. I mean, I've cleaned salmon so many times before that I don't really have to focus on cleaning the salmon. It's almost like muscle memory, and I can be thinking about more other things, like what am I going to do with the salmon when I get it cleaned?
Have you been influenced by any religion that has helped you be more mindful? Because you're talking as somebody who might do yoga or meditation, or even, you know, Judaism is about the present. So there's a lot of religious spiritual components to what you're talking about.
People have said that to me before. Other than as a young boy, I went to Catholic school, and one of the things I did every day was be an altar boy at Mass, and that was something 7 a.m. Mass. I was there, you know, 5 days a week or 6 days a week, because then it was also Sunday. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really have much. Later in life, I didn't have a strong connection to religion, and certainly meditation or any kind of spiritual enlightenment is not part of my. Never been part of my life, really. So I'm not sure where it comes from.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. He's the first American chef to be awarded 3 Michelin stars for both of his fine dining restaurants, the French Laundry in Napa Valley, California, and Per Se in New York City. You spent your early life in California before moving to Florida. Your parents were divorced. Your father was a Marine drill instructor, and he left your mother when you were 5 or 6 years old with you and your 4 brothers.
Correct.
What influence did your father's absence in your life have on you?
My mother and father didn't have a very good separation, so they didn't part on friendly terms. So, you know, growing up, and I was 4 years old when they separated, so my whole life was with my mother and my brothers. Mm-hmm. My father wasn't really part of it. He was somebody who lived in Pennsylvania. I don't want to say I didn't have any need for him, but I didn't have an apparent need for him. I certainly had those father figures in my older brothers. They were my role models. They were my teachers, you know, from a masculine point of view. And my mother was there. My mother was an amazing person, very dedicated, committed to her children and their well-being. And she ran restaurants. So she was gone in many evenings, which left the older brothers, my older brothers, to kind of cook for us and babysit us, which was fine. But I didn't grow up on, you know, sitting on my mother's knees during the polenta or my grandmother's, you know, in my grandmother's kitchen, you know, baking biscuits. But as I started to grow older, I spent more and more time at the restaurant. And I really enjoyed those moments in my mother's restaurant, in those kitchens.
When you say your mother's restaurant, she was a restaurant manager of an existing restaurant.
Exactly.
In Florida.
She didn't own the restaurant. She ran the restaurants, yes.
What are some of those early memories that you have with her in the restaurant?
Well, you know, the restaurants are very nurturing places. And at the same time, kitchens can be very violent places. Mm-hmm. So you have this real dichotomy between these two environments. You have these individuals in there who are continuously cooking for people and nurturing them. But at the same time, you have sharp knives, you have wet floors, you have steam, you have heat, you have all these different things going on. So you really have to be aware in a kitchen. And I think awareness was key for me. And I think that was one of the great things I learned early on from my mother and being in those kitchens was a sense of awareness of everything that's around me and being careful.
Hmm. When you were with your mother in those earlier years, did you have thoughts of, you know, this is where I want to make my life? When did that come to mature?
Well, I never thought about being a chef in those early days. When I did venture out on my own and have a job in the real world, which was in construction, my older brothers were in construction, so I kind of migrated towards that. But once I found my way back into the kitchen, and although I didn't realize it at that time, looking back at that moment washing dishes at the Palm Beach Yacht Club really prepared me to be a cook, because the actions that you are doing as a dishwasher, the same things that you're going to be doing as a cook. In other words, it's about organization. So as all the dirty dishes and silverware and glasses come in, you have to be extremely organized. You have to have them stacked correctly. You have to have them piled. You have to have the water ready for the silverware. You have to be efficient. So you have to be able to stack the plates up correctly or get the silverware done correctly so that you're efficient in your movement, so you're not wasting any time. You get instant feedback. You know, if you don't scrape the dishes correctly or spray them down correctly before they go in the dish machine, they come out dirty. Mm-hmm. And then you learn to be part of a team. And everybody in the restaurant relies on you. So those were four critical elements of being a really good dishwasher that you translate to being a really good cook.
Yeah. It was washing dishes that helped you realize, you know what, I can make a life in the kitchen. But you had a level of organization and almost compulsiveness for cleanliness and precision, even outside the kitchen, in your home growing up. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what you were like in your own home?
Well, my mother was meticulous. I mean, the house had to be clean all the time. And you take your shoes off before you went inside, you know, I mean, at one point, I remember in my life, the furniture was covered in plastic wrap, you know, to protect the fabric. We all had chores every week. My brothers and I always had chores. And Joseph and I, being the youngest, would always have to do the chores of the oldest. I was the one that always had to clean the bathroom, and that was probably the most difficult and certainly the most... You really became aware of how clean it was.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. We'll hear more from Thomas coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. His restaurants include the French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon, Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc. The French Laundry and Per Se hold three Michelin stars, and Thomas has won Best Chef Awards from the James Beard Foundation, among other accolades. You weren't surrounded by, you know, this rich culinary life growing up in any way. How did that transition occur from, you know, washing dishes in a, you know, random restaurant with your mom to actually acquiring this awareness of this whole other culinary world?
So if you think back at the Palm Beach Yacht Club, I was washing dishes. And one day my mother came to me and said, you know, Richard, who was the chef at the time, you know, Richard's going to leave in a couple weeks. So, you know, if you watch what he does, we're going to make you the chef.
How old were you?
I was probably 19.
Okay.
And I thought, wow, this is interesting. But I did have a leg up. My brother Joseph was already in the profession. He had decided at a relatively young age, 12 or 13, that he really wanted to be a chef. And Richard did show me. He showed me how to make an omelet. He showed me how to, you know, grill a flank steak, make hamburgers, things like that. And that's really what basically it was. The most difficult thing I had to do every day was make a hollandaise sauce. And my brother Joseph was very influential in helping me do that.
But no formal training ever.
No formal training. But there was really not an option. There wasn't a lot of options back in 1974 for formal training. Cooking wasn't viewed as it is today. There was really not a whole lot of interest in becoming a chef.
You had the reputation of managing your kitchen as if you were a military marine drill instructor like your father. And it's almost trite to ask, mm-hmm. you know, what parallels are there between you and your father? But how has that occurred to you?
Well, you're right. I mean, absolutely. There is a definite hierarchy in the kitchen. That hierarchy was defined by Augustus Escoffier in the turn of the 1900s.
Is this the brigade system?
The brigade system. Yeah. So you have a brigade or brigade. I mean, brigade in French, brigade in America. And I mean, there's you know, the hierarchy. There's the chef who's the leader. Then there's the sous chefs, demi sous chefs, chef de parties, commis. So you have this real hierarchy of how the kitchen operates. And when you think about a kitchen, especially during service or most of the time, it's about command response. And when you think about it, that initial command really comes from the guest. Mm-hmm. You sit down at the table, you look at the menu, and you choose what you want to eat. And you tell the waiter. And that's your command. Then all of a sudden, as the chef, then you tell all the chef de parties what needs to be done. And they respond. So from a militaristic point of view, it's the same in the military. It's all about command response.
Was it striking to you that, my career is paralleling my father's to a large degree?
It was a little bit. I didn't really think about it until much later in life. Much later in life, my early 20s, when I really started to think about it and I started to reach out to my father to reconnect with my father at that time in my life.
And when you did reach out to him, you really reconnected in a big way. Your father moved from Pennsylvania to California to be with you at the French Laundry.
Yes.
In Napa Valley. And he died after having a car accident about a year after?
About a year and a half after he arrived in Yountville. He had a horrific car accident that left him a quadriplegic. And that was one of the most challenging moments of my life is to prepare him to come home, his home in Yountville.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. He was awarded France's highest culinary decoration, the Légion d'Honneur, for popularizing French cuisine in America in 2011. So you found your home in the French Laundry, and it took you about 2 years to raise $1.5 million to get the restaurant off the ground. Who did you raise the capital from?
Yeah, it was $1.2 million. But I mean, back then that was, you know, I mean, when you don't have any money, you know, a substantial amount of money was an enormous amount of money to me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went through three different avenues to raise the money. One was a commercial bank loan, real estate loan. Although I realized that once I started to apply for the bank loans, the failure here in New York City came to be a problem. So I had to have my old partner Serge Raoul, who really went out on a limb for me financially, come back and satisfy some of the debt that was still outstanding at Raquel. Mm. So, you know, when you think about the people that are involved in your life and how they come to your aid in some of the most unpredictable ways. I mean, certainly we had a failed restaurant. We had parted ways. I was gone for 3.5 years. And all of a sudden, I need him to come back and satisfy a financial debt for us. And so, you know, that was one of the first individuals that, you know, really stepped up to the plate to help. The second part was a small business administrative loan. And we were very fortunate that I was very fortunate at that time. President Clinton had just come into office. He was trying to re-energize the economy. So he funded the SBA in a significant way. And, you know, a white, middle-class, educated male was not the profile for the SBA prior to that. And then finally, the last component was going out to private individuals for private placement. And I reached out to probably over 400 people. And that was probably the most difficult part of my life, trying to sell this project. And out of 400, we had 50 people who finally signed a check. And that was the final straw that helped me buy the French Laundry.
And the French Laundry in the 1880s, when it was first built, was actually a bar.
Before Prohibition, it was opened as a saloon gambling brothel. Yountville, in that time, we have a veterans home there, which is the oldest veterans home in America, or in California, I'm sorry. And then what happened really is the state really got tired of all the problems they were having in Yountville. So they passed a law that there wasn't a lot of alcohol served within 2 miles of the veterans home. Hmm. So that shut down Yountville. Hmm. And that's when a young French couple, bought the property. Yountville, Napa Valley at that time still was a place that many of the social elite from San Francisco would summer in. So their business model was to you know, service all of these the socialites in their homes with the laundry service. And hence, that was where the French Laundry began.
After 10 years of French Laundry, you opened Per Se in 2004 in New York City. So you returned to the city that rejected you in the earliest days. How did that relationship with the Time Warner Center originate?
Time Warner Center was being developed by the Related Group. At that time, they were really looking towards France to come and occupy and build the restaurants there. At the same time, one or two of the French chefs that just arrived in America received some less than flattering reviews. So they kind of repositioned themselves and said, okay, let's not go to France. Let's look into America. And they reached out to me to see if I'd be interested in being one of their tenants. And I had looked at New York once in a while, you know, mm-hmm. through the history of the French Laundry. You know, people would always say, when are you coming home? You know, home being New York City. If I was going to do another fine dining restaurant, there's really no other city in America to do it. And the Time Warner Center really offered us an opportunity to do it in a significant way.
You had a charmed life with French Laundry, but Per Se had an inauspicious start. There was a fire which mm-hmm. set you back. Can you talk to me about
the
that
fire.
Episode?
We opened the restaurant on February 19th in 2004, a little less than 10 years after we opened the French Laundry, and we had closed the French Laundry and brought 30 of those individuals to Per Se to help inoculate and train the new team. So we were off to a great start. And then on that, the 26th of February, it was right at staff meal. And I was in the butcher room with two of my sous chefs and we were chatting. And we started to smell smoke. Then we started to see smoke. And that's when I evacuated the kitchen, the restaurant. We called the fire department. And that was basically what I thought was the beginning of end. And I stood there when that young fireman, you know, standing on top of the tables and just taking that big axe and going through the wall and the flame shooting out and water pouring out everywhere. And I thought, you know, I called my attorney and I said, I got to get out of here. But the next day we came back and, you know, we had a whole different attitude. We're going to now have a second chance to open this restaurant. And then I started getting cards from our Asian guests, and they were all flowers were coming and congratulations were coming because in Asia, if you have a fire in your kitchen, it means you're going to be successful. So it's just, it was a matter of point of view.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. I want to talk about just the experience of dining in the French Laundry or Per Se. The menus change every day in both restaurants. And you've said that you don't repeat any ingredients in the 9 courses. Is that true?
We repeat luxury ingredients. So there may be truffles twice, or there may be foie gras twice. But we would never have mushrooms twice, or carrots twice, or turnips twice, or things like that.
Do you think the clientele would really mind?
Well, you know, at some point, as much as we appreciate and work for our guests, it's really about us. You know, it's about our values and our standards and challenging ourselves. And it was really a challenge in the beginning. Okay, we're not going to repeat any garnishes, any vegetables. Why would we? We're the French Laundry.
And we're going to have a new menu every day.
Right.
Can you walk me through some of the items on your menus that you are particularly fond of?
Some of the signature dishes, or some of the iconic dishes anyway, certainly the coronet of salmon. And what that is, it really looks like a miniature ice cream cone. And the inspiration from that ice cream cone, for that dish came from my experience eating ice cream cones.
At Baskin and Robbins.
Here in Chinatown, exactly. And that's where when you think about awareness, how important awareness is, because you can look at something every day or every week or experience something over and over again and never really realize the full potential of what that is. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until that day in 1991 when I was at Baskin Robbins and the ice cream cone was put in front of me, did I see the coronet?
How about the oysters and pearls, which is another iconic offering of yours?
Exactly. It's one of those iconic dishes that is prepared every day. It was a purple box. And I was walking down the aisle of a grocery store and I saw a purple box. And on the purple box, it said, you know, pearl tapioca. And I'm thinking, where do pearls come from? Pearls come from oysters. And therefore, you know, I bought a box of pearl tapioca, took it back to the French Laundry, and knew exactly what I was going to do with it. And there we have oysters and pearls.
And there is a level of playfulness on the menu, per se, mm-hmm. which seems surprising perhaps to people who go because, oh, this is a fine dining establishment and they might expect it to be stuffier than it certainly is.
If you've experienced macaroni and cheese before, I think, which we all have, we can reinterpret that in a way that's going to be significant. And you're going to go, wow, that's just like the best macaroni and cheese I've ever had. Mm-hmm. Coffee and donuts, is another one of those iconic dishes. And when you think about, fine dining restaurants historically have always been intimidating. And it's something that I don't want to represent in our restaurants. And so when you get that cornet, I mean, you have to smile. It's just so darn cute.
The law of diminishing marginal returns is important to you, and the idea is when you are giving people their food, you give them just enough to keep it interesting before they move on to the next.
Exactly, exactly. You know, and you think about the law of diminishing returns, it's something that came evident to me when I was a young person living in Florida, and we would go to the beach on Saturday and have beer. And that first cold beer on a hot summer day was really amazing, really refreshing, really good. And of course, by the time the second one came around, it was less, and the third one was even less so. I translated that into the way I thought about food.
There's a comedian, Louis C.K. He says, some people might eat until they're full and then move and then stop, but I eat until I'm ashamed. What are your own eating habits?
I try to eat healthy, of course. I don't try to eat a lot of food. I try, in the morning, it's very ritualistic. Typically, I'll have, some type of granola with chia seeds and some ground flaxseed, which I grind myself. Then I'll have my vitamin regimen with some juice or some probiotics, and then I'll have coffee. And then, throughout the day, I typically eat with the team at the restaurant. I'm eating at 8 a.m. in the morning, at noon, and then again at 4:45, because that's when we serve our p.m. meal. So if I stay on that schedule, I feel really, really good.
I want to talk about your suppliers. You have more than 350 suppliers
For the restaurant, yeah. Suppliers come and go depending on the season, depending on what they're growing, depending on where they are.
Can you provide some examples of your suppliers, some of the stories of your suppliers?
There are so many. Ingrid Benjes, who's in Stonington, Maine, who is accidental. I mean, she was an author. She moved to Maine, and she was trying to make a living. And she found some mushrooms and found a home for them at Balducci's here in New York. And they said, well, what else do you have? And she said, well, I'm from Maine. Maybe I can get you lobsters. And so that was almost 40 years ago, Diane St. Clair in Orwell, Vermont. She gets up every day, 7 days a week at 4 a.m. to milk the cows by 6 so that she can start making the butter, that she cultured the day before, make 20 pounds of butter a day.
Incidentally, I have to mention, I was reading New York Magazine recently, and there's this this piece on Per Se talking about, that trysts happen. You're working intensely with people, and you become intimate with them. That is true for you, too.
It is.
You hired Laura Cunningham, who was your restaurant manager, really
Correct.
Your first hire mm-hmm. at the French Laundry, and she's now your partner.
Exactly.
Can you describe that evolution?
Well, it's in we work so hard and so long, so many hours, you're right. You really become intimate with the individuals that you're working with in so many ways, and it's always kind of difficult when you begin a personal relationship with a coworker, mm-hmm. but no more so than with Laura and I. Because at the French Laundry, when we were both working at the French Laundry, every day together, we lived next door. It really became a true family kind of environment. I mean, if mother wouldn't let you do something, let's go ask father.
You have this reputation for being really very control-oriented. And in fact, you said a kitchen is about control at any level. But do you think you're any different from the top chefs? There's this element of
control.
Yeah.
We're control freaks. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, chefs, historically, I mean, by nature, are control freaks. They want to control. They need to control what's going on in their kitchen so that they're controlling what's going on in the dining room. We talk about emotional chefs, most chefs that have outbursts and, get upset. And where that comes from, I mean, the genesis of that is something happening that prevents me from giving you, the guest, the experience that I want. Because if something comes in the way of that, something clogs that, then there's a problem.
Have you in the past, like, worried, I'm not going to be very well liked if I'm going to be so control-oriented? Like, did you ever have to kind of grapple with that for yourself?
Yeah, you do. I mean, when I was younger, I mean, those emotional outbursts, you know, sometimes became personal. And you realize that that's not the way to operate. That's not respectful. And you ended up going back to the person that you had that emotional outburst. And you had to apologize to that person.
What's an example? We talk at 30,000 feet of, you know, your attention to detail and your control orientation. What's an example of that in the kitchen day to day?
Everything's about precision.
But what's an example?
Okay, an example is, let's take something as simple as knife skills. You know, cutting brunoise of vegetables. Brunoise of vegetables is something that's 1/8 of an inch square. Mm-hmm. You know, and being able to make sure that the mandolin that you have that slices the elongated piece of vegetable is really, really sharp and has the right calibration in terms of thickness. And then that your knife skills, because then your knife skills come, because then you're slicing that long, thin julienne vegetable into a brunoise. Let's talk about canneling.
What's
canneling? Canneling is having two spoons. And canneling is something that we do in so many different ways. It's making something in the shape of an egg.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So a canal is something that's the shape of an egg. If you're canneling sorbet or ice cream, you know, it really requires the sorbet or the ice cream to be a specific temperature. And it requires you to have a spoon that's clean and hot so that when you move your spoon through the ice cream or sorbet, the sorbet just folds over itself and forms this perfect egg-shaped canal of ice cream. Or if you're using two spoons, when we're canneling the caviar for the oyster and pearl, for example, making sure that you have enough caviar on the spoon and your spoons are clean and accurate so that, and your movement back and forth to create this shape that you're then going to put on the dish, which is oysters and pearls, which is the first dish that our guests really receive and something that's so impactful for them.
Do you have the same level of precision in your personal life?
Habits are really important. So I think it's important that you recognize a certain standard. And many of us, let's take a T-shirt, for example. You may have a little hole in your T-shirt, and nobody really sees it. So is it to your standard to know that you're wearing a T-shirt that has a hole in it? Or is your standard so that you know there's a hole in it, it's not acceptable even to you, even though no one else sees it, and you get a new T-shirt?
And what is your standard?
New T-shirt.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been the chef Thomas Keller.
Coming up, we'll meet Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo, the first company to make digital video recorders, or DVRs, which allow consumers to record TV programs, skip over ads, or watch the programs at their convenience. Jim started TiVo in 1997 with his partner, Michael Ramsey. Jim worked at Hewlett-Packard, Bell Labs, and Silicon Graphics prior to starting TiVo. Welcome.
Well, thanks. Thank you very much.
So, Jim, what role did TV play in your life growing up?
As a child, I was raised with the TV in the house. I even have some very dim memories of the transition from black and white to color television. I watched every episode of Star Trek many times and could repeat a lot of the dialogue. I was like a lot of men, I think, in terms of once you got the remote control, you just sit there and flip channels. And looking for something interesting to watch. I don't do that anymore.
I notice how you said a lot of men use the remote control. It's so true. Why don't you think more women use the remote control for surfing television as much as men do?
I don't know. Maybe we're just more easily bored by the stuff that's on television.
You got your bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and your master's degree in computer science. Did you have any idea then that you would be working on television projects, or what did you want to do with those degrees, did you think?
When I left college, it was really a focus on computers and computer networking, programming, things like that. It wasn't until I was working for Silicon Graphics in the early 90s that I started to get involved with television. As and digital television.
You left Silicon Graphics in 1996. When you left, you started your own company called Network Age Software. What was the goal for this company?
Well, in working with especially the full-service network and looking at all the interactive TV work that had gone on, I felt that there was an opportunity in the management and moving around of huge amounts of digital information. The movies, for instance, that were played back over the Time Warner, the video on demand system, were simply massive, many gigabytes of data. So I felt there's an opportunity to build software to manage how you move data around. I had developed that company for about a year, and at that time, Mike had just left Silicon Graphics. And so I called him up and said, let's do lunch. We had a nice lunch, but we started talking about how we both were very interested in starting up something from scratch. And as we started talking, we both came to the notion that there was going to be an opportunity in the home for people, that music was starting to be digital, most television content and movie content would be digital over time, and that we had an opportunity there to put together a company and a product that would help people in managing all this stuff in your home.
Incidentally, you had been a good soldier working at Hewlett-Packard and Bell Labs and Silicon Graphics, these very large companies. And here you are now venturing out on your own, first by yourself and then with Michael. How did you feel?
Well, as you point out, I'd been, coddled in the big corporate world for a while. And the thought of stepping out on my own and trying something was scary, frankly. But after a while, it was as if a weight had lifted off my shoulders because working for SGI had actually been very stressful, and I didn't quite realize how stressful it was until I left. And at that point, I started feeling much better about the decision and stopped being afraid.
Do you remember some of the early days when, or some of those first mornings when you woke up and you didn't have to get in the car and go to work?
Yeah, I do. One part of it was disciplining myself to be able to, you go and you eat breakfast and do whatever and then sit down and work. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really sat down and worked at home before.
How did your wife feel about it?
Well, frankly, at the time, she said, you need to do whatever is right for you. Just make sure we don't lose the house. And so I made sure we didn't lose the house.
You and Michael decide to start this company together. But the project that you were working on initially was far from the TiVo product that you ultimately developed. You started to create a home network system where you would have a sensor in the refrigerator telling the consumer when their milk was sour. Could you give other examples of the practical implications of what the technology that this home network system could do?
We had the notion that you'd be able to plug your camera in and download pictures off of your camera. That you would have one of these small satellite set-tops that connected to your home stereo system and allow you to play back your music. It might hook to your phone system and be sort of a personal voicemail. I have a slide that I did at that time where I put all these things on one slide, and we called it the Grand Vision slide. I think I had a coffee maker on there that might be controlled. It was a field of dreams. But as we dove in to fleshing it out and starting to line up the technologies we'd need to actually make this stuff work, it became clear that the networking technology available at that time wasn't going to be sufficient to handle the kinds of kept data that we were going to thinking about moving around. I don't remember exactly how it happened, but Mike and I were sitting around and talking one day, and it might have been with some other people too, and somebody said, well, wouldn't it be great if you could pause live television? And I thought, well, that's sort of an interesting notion. I wonder if we could do that. And as I sat there for a minute, I went, I I understand enough about computers and digital content and everything. You know, I could do that. I could figure out how to do that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo. Jim founded TiVo in 1997 with his partner, Michael Ramsey, and the company was first profitable in 2005. So finally, you had this aha moment where you said, okay, let's focus our technology on building this device for television. Talk to me about how venture capitalists receive this idea.
The initial idea was this home server on a home network distributing media throughout your home. And it was interesting. The two venture firms that we worked with, NEA and IVP, both had partners at those firms that knew Mike and I from previous experiences at Silicon Graphics. I remember one of the partners, his name was Jeff Yang. He says, you know, this is a crazy idea. I don't know how you're going to do it, but I'll bet you guys are going to come up with something. So they didn't really fund us based on the idea. They funded us based on it being Mike and I.
So you were well received by the venture capital community, but did you expect the degree of controversy that would come from elsewhere, you know, from the TV, the cable companies?
You mean in terms of skipping ads?
Exactly.
Yes and no. I didn't particularly like watching commercials, and I was more than happy to build a device that could allow you to skip over them. At the same time, we knew that the networks, especially who derived all their revenue from advertising, would be very nervous about this technology. So we went to them very early on at TiVo, and we said, look at what we're building. Said, you know, this thing is coming, but in years down the road, it's going to be very common. And what you should do is get on board now. In fact, we think you should invest in TiVo and make sure that instead of running away from this thing, that you're part of it. You know, if you're going to take away the 30-second spot, then we felt we needed to give back other ways of advertising, other ways of reaching the consumer within TiVo. And so we developed quite a large number of different kinds of interactive advertising technologies that are still with us today.
So what was their response?
Well, it depends. Advertisers were actually quite excited about the potential and the possibilities that we were showing them, new ways to advertise to get beyond the 30-second spot. The networks were sort of split. There were some that were very far-sighted, and there were other entities that were very afraid.
And didn't one network executive ask Michael if he was the devil?
that he probably did.
Were you in that meeting?
No, I wasn't. Mm. Michael tended to be the guy out talking a lot to everybody, where I like to be, you know, back in the lab working on actually making things work.
You talk about other potential revenue models for the networks if you were going to be threatening these 30-second ads, and that raises an issue of privacy concerns. You know, you'd have to inherently be giving or releasing data about your viewers because you have this information, and that caused some viewers to, you know, feel uncomfortable.
Well, we were very concerned about maintaining people's privacy, but still being able to build a business. You know, the engineers at TiVo, especially in those days, in the early days, we were all a bunch of libertarian software engineers, and we didn't want anybody invading our privacy either. So we were very careful about how we constructed the systems for collecting data in such a way that we could guarantee people's privacy and still be able to aggregate the kind of information that networks and advertisers would really want to have. In fact, early on, we had a customer who hooked up to the phone line going in and out of the TiVo and saw the data going back and forth and called up his congressman who asked the FTC to investigate us. Which was fine because we were able to demonstrate to the FTC, to their total satisfaction, that we couldn't going back and correlate the data that came back to us with an individual.
While you had a relatively easy time raising capital, whether it was from the venture capitalists or from some of the media companies like NBC or AOL, which invested $200 million, you faced a lot of hurdles elsewhere, for instance, in just by consumers. Consumer adoption wasn't as quick, perhaps, as you thought it would be. Were you surprised by the lackluster response of consumers in the early days? I know people were very excited about this new technology, but it really took a while for consumer adoption to ramp up.
Yes, it did. And I think we were surprised about that because having built prototypes and everybody in the company took them home and lived with these things, we all understood how life-changing the technology was. I think the problem that we face it, we didn't quite understand at first, was that for most people, they didn't think of television as being broken. So coming in with a new concept that says, now you actually can totally control your viewing, most people didn't quite compute that at first because there wasn't a space in it in their head that neatly fit into. And so in the early days, a lot of our efforts were around education of the market.
One of the challenges to consumer adoption might have been the price. TiVo was $499 plus a $9.95 a month fee on top of that. And you took efforts to subsidize that price. What are some other examples of some hurdles that you faced early on, aside from the consumer adoption issue?
The early days of TiVo were sort of a heady time. We were there in that phase of the expansion of the internet bubble. We went public in September of 1999. The stock was priced at $16 and hit $78 on that same day. Of course, not long after that, we had the bursting, if you will, of the internet bubble, and funding dried up. I remember when we had to make the very difficult decision in 2001 to lay off people in the company. And having to do a layoff was a huge emotional downer, because we had so built the company on taking care of people, but we really had no choice if we wanted to stay in business. And then what happened was Philips and Sony and some of the other partners you're working with decided that they didn't want to work with us anymore because we wouldn't pay them a subsidy anymore on their products. And so we got to a point where we were down to our last tens of millions of dollars in the bank and had no distribution. And we sat around and looked at each other and said, we're not quitting. If we have to, we'll throw these things on the back of a truck and we'll drive them around and sell them on the back of the truck. We never quite had to do that because by that time, Best Buy had become very interested in TiVo, the brand, and we signed a deal with them where they distributed TiVo boxes, and that allowed us to skate through that time of thin amounts of money and come out the other side in a way as strong or stronger than we'd ever been.
Just on an existential level, since you really were the pioneer behind the DVR or the digital video recorder, how do you feel about being on the founding team that developed this technology, which is becoming more pervasive, even if it's not in the form of a TiVo machine?
Well, I found it incredibly gratifying. It still happens today, but in the early days, I'd be talking to somebody and say, oh yeah, I'm with TiVo. And it was like, TiVo, you're with TiVo? That's the greatest thing in the world. Mm-hmm. I've had people come up and say, my three-year-old can use the TiVo. It's so easy to use. My grandmother uses it with no trouble at all. It's interesting to me that a lot of the technology that we developed, we've been able to license to a lot of different people. It's used in quite a few different DVRs that aren't under the TiVo brand. So from a pure technology intellectual property point of view, it's also gratifying to have developed something that has become so pervasive for people in their lives.
even the word TiVo has become generic and is used as a verb, you know, oh, I TiVo this show, I TiVo that show, you know, kind of like Kleenex or Band-Aids. How did you feel about that term becoming generic?
You know, it's a two-faced thing. It's really gratifying to have created a verb, created a whole concept for people that they want to talk about it that way. On the other hand, the control of TiVo, there's a particular whole set of legal steps that we need to take to protect our trademark, to protect that verb. And so we have to take actual action to tell people when they use TiVo as a generic verb that, no, you can't do that.
How did you come up with the name originally?
Teleworld was the name we came up with originally when we first got funded by the venture capitalists. It was really a placeholder name until we went through a whole exercise, a naming exercise, and started off with 800 names on a wall. What we did at the company is we actually took all the different names that had been thought of and posted them on the walls. And then everybody got a sticker that they could go and stick on whichever piece of paper had the name that they liked. But there was a formal acknowledgement that there was Texas and California, which is me and Mike, and that we got the big vote in the end.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. I was pleased and flattered that you asked me to join.
My guest has been Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.